How important are rhythm and rhythmic habits to our religious experience? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, Professor Emeritus in the WWU School of Theology. I'm your host and study guide author. We continue our series on rest in Christ. My conversation partners, again, are Dave Thomas, Professor of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Phil Mothersbaugh, retired pastor and an adjunct teacher in the School of Theology. So let's come and look at that. But before we look at rhythm in the religious life, I would like to back up one step and talk about rhythmic patterns in life in general. Are some people more committed to habit than others? Could we perhaps contrast the structured person with the spontaneous one?
And could we ask if the spontaneous people have rhythms?
Do they?
Well, I think so. They're just not well organized.
They're mostly musicians.
Phil, you're going out on a limb on your own on that one.
I am. But I think my fellow musicians can relate. You know, sometimes our creativity allows us to find a way to express our creativity through rhythm, but that's not the only kind of rhythm that we're talking about today, I'm sure.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think people live random lives, Alden. I don't think even spontaneous people don't just live random lives. They're not highly structured like more structured people, but I think
Another interesting wrinkle which I just thought of, that if you take creative people who are religious people, they tend to go towards the liturgical churches where they are highly structured. Everything fits in place.
You think so?
Huh?
You think so?
Yeah, I know so. But if you have some areas of your life that are loose, then you need others that are stronger to help keep you in place. And that's why almost no one is liberal in every aspect.
There are some dimensions to rhythm in this discussion, because it's not just a simple 4-4 time. We're not just talking about something like beating a drum. There's lots of different kinds of rhythms.
Yeah. Well, let's come now to our question. What is it about Sabbath that separates it from the rest of the creation week?
Well, if we look at the Sabbath as the conclusion of the week, if I can just jump in here, we find out that as we look at that week, that we have inherited the week as it's described in Scripture, with the Sabbath as a point of repetition, but a very special one. It's the conclusion of creative work that the Bible helps us understand, that God pauses as a result of all he's done in 6 days.
Well, I think also the mandates about Sabbath make it a different day, where you're not supposed to use it as a routine day of working, and you're supposed to make sure that other people get rest, even you rest, and that other people get to rest. Even animals have time to rest.
Yeah, and we'll come to those aspects. I want to read the quote from the official study guide, because it's really quite nice. After all this active creating, God turned his attention to something else. First glance, it did not seem as spectacular as leaping whales or dazzling feather displays. God simply made a day, a seventh day, and then he made it special. Even before humanity would dash off on our self-imposed stressful lives, God set a marker as a living memory aid. God wanted this day to be a time for us to stop and deliberately enjoy life, a day to be and not do, to celebrate the gift of grass, air, wildlife, water, people, and most of all, the creator of every good gift. This invitation would continue even after the first couple was exiled from Eden. God wanted to make sure that the invitation would stand the test of time. So right from the beginning, he knit it into the very fabric of time itself. I like that. That's a nice summary. So during this week, we will study God's wonderful invitation to enter into a dynamic rest again and again, every seventh day. Now, a question. The Greeks' assessment of the material world was that it was bad. For them, only the immaterial and the spiritual was good. So how does the Bible value the created material world? Does it say that it is good, bad, or indifferent?
Alden, I think this is a fascinating question because, you know, I feel like one of the big deficiencies in my life is that I don't know as much about Greek philosophy as I would like to have known. But this distinction you touched on is a very big one, that in the Greek world, the physical world realm had a diminished place. It was a diminished existence, and you were very unfortunate that your soul was somehow caught in the material world. And, you know, the idea of keeping the body down, of asceticism, of sexual abstinence, of all these kind of things arises from the idea that the physical realm, which includes the human body, is a diminished place. In the creation story, you have an astonishing difference in that every day, at the end of the day, a statement is made that this is good. It's good, it's good, it's good. And the summary at the end is it's very good. The whole deal is very good. Of course, in its proper place. And so here's one place where I think the Bible departs very dramatically from the philosophers, is that the material and the spiritual are not at odds. They are not antagonistic to each other. There's a symbiosis going on there, that spiritual and the physical are tied together in a very holistic manner.
You know, I was intrigued by a book. In fact, it was one my teachers taught us. Oscar Coleman, well-known New Testament scholar, first published a book entitled Immortality of the Soul or Resurrection of the Dead.
Ooh.
And his thesis was that resurrection is clearly rooted in the doctrine of creation, whereas the immortality of the soul wants to escape the prison of the body. And he was, let me just read you a few lines, his reaction, because he was well published many books. But this is what he says, and it's in the introduction to the Wipfen Stock edition of the book, which is currently in print. He said, "No other publication of mine has provoked such enthusiasm or such violent hostility. The editors of the periodicals concerned have been good enough to send me some of the letters of protest which they have received from their readers. One of the letter writers was prompted by my article to reflect bitterly that, quotes, the French people, dying for lack of bread of life, have been offered instead of bread, stones, if not serpents. Another writer takes me for a kind of monster who delights in causing spiritual distress. As M. Kuhlmann, he writes, a stone instead of a heart. For a third, my study has been the cause of astonishment, sorrow, and deep distress. Friends who have followed my previous work with interest and approval have indicated to me the pain which this study has caused them. In others, I have detected a malaise which they have tried to conceal by an eloquent silence. My critics belong to the most varied camps. The contrast which, out of concern for the truth, I have found it necessary to draw between the courageous and joyful primitive Christian hope of the resurrection of the dead and the serene philosophical expectation of the survival of the immortal soul has displeased not only many sincere Christians in all communions and of all theological outlooks, but also those whose convictions, while not outwardly alienated from Christianity, are more strongly molded by philosophical considerations. But this point is so far. No critic of either kind has attempted to refute me by exegesis being the basis of our study."
You know, that thought of Coleman's speaks to the dualism that Dave was referring to earlier about the material aspect of life being bad and the spiritual being good. Thus, he brings to the foreground the lingering remnants of Greek philosophy. And he's speaking to that in this very quote.
Well, I don't think it's lingering remnants. You know, this idea has infused the majority of Christian theology with the idea that eternity is linked to an inherently immortal soul. The Bible does not offer us that. It's tied very definitely to the resurrection of the body, not to the immortality of the soul. And that whole debate is imported directly from Greek philosophy, not found in the Bible. And Kuhlmann is absolutely right here. By exegesis, you will not dismantle his statements.
Yep. No, the creation is good.
Yeah.
And the body is worth resurrecting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the body is good and its functions are good, but you have to be careful because they can enslave you, as Paul said in Ephesians 2,
sure,
because of sin.
So I understated it. It's rather a large fragment left over.
Yes,
so
large. So now you can't even use the word fragment, Phil.
Okay.
So you have to.
I'll pick another one.
A large piece.
A large piece. Yeah. A large stumbling stone.
A large section.
Now, the one question, and this is an intriguing one, because I had a retired pastor, a very conservative pastor, but he was beginning to wake up and asking questions. And I won't go through all of that dialogue, but my question to you is, how does the creation of the man in Genesis 1 differ from God's method as described in Genesis 2?
Well, I think if you read the chapters carefully, you discover that in Genesis 1 is kind of a generic, this is what God did. But when it comes to the creation of man, it becomes more personal in chapter 2.
It's really quite intriguing because there are really two issues that God needed to address here. Because in pagan creation accounts, there's almost always a battle of the chaos monsters. So creation emerges from what happens, you see.
Right.
And that's...
The Babylonian Genesis comes to mind right here, you know, the story of creation.
So on one hand, God needed to say that this is not battle of the chaos monsters. God creates, so you have a distant God he creates by the word. But the problem with that is that you then have a God who appears to be very distant and unfeeling. So you tell another story. And this is a time where God gets his hands dirty. And he brings the animals to man, and he creates a woman from the man. So it's really quite a sharp contrast. And you have to be able to tell both stories, or you take the shine off of them both. You kind of have to put them side by side. The other thing that we need to remember here is that the remembering of the Sabbath is an important point as well.
But that's about as rhythmical as you can get. Every week it comes.
Yep, every question it comes. And the miracle of the manna, which comes when they get to the Exodus, is simply a way of reinforcing that memory. Mm-hmm. And it happens twice every weekend. Double manna on Friday and none on Sabbath.
Yeah.
So that when Israel came to the mountain, they were ready to hear, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. My thanks to our conversation partners, Dave Thomas and Phil Mothersbaugh, to our technical support staff, Kristen Byerly and Rick Baskett, and to all of you for listening in for the Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.